For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
I think we ought to be both mentally and otherwise prepared for a major outbreak anywhere in the country.
That's the voice of Laureate Professor Nick Talley, AC, the Editor-in-Chief of the MJA. Nick has been a regular commentator on the COVID-19 pandemic over the past year. Just recently, he and Jeremy Howard from the University of San Francisco wrote a piece for the Sydney Morning Herald in which they detailed just why Australia's vaccination rollout actually is a race. Nick is my boss and he's also my special guest today. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Kate. Pleased to be here.
What prompted you to write this article with Jeremy for the Sydney Morning Herald?
Well, I think it's fair to say that both of us were very concerned about the low vaccine uptake. What we were hearing was more and more vaccine hesitancy, at least on social media, and it certainly appeared to be real. Understandable vaccine hesitancy in the setting of a serious outbreak in Melbourne, which potentially could occur anywhere in the country and still could occur anywhere in the country. So we felt it was important to get the message out there that, in fact, waiting for the vaccination puts you at much higher risk than having the vaccination. And that's because it takes time to get protected. Even Pfizer, it takes, 3 weeks between doses and at least a few more weeks before you've got significant protection. Well, that's still a significant amount of time. And for AstraZeneca, it's a 3-month gap between vaccinations. And again, a little bit more time after that even to get full protection. And you need, for some of these variants, and we don't know what's going to escape in the future, some of these variants, you've got to have both doses.
Yes.
So to us, it seemed like a very important time. And I guess the other comment is, some people seem to think we could have a leisurely pace out. That wasn't something that we could agree with.
What are you hearing about the possibilities of being able to mix and match the vaccines?
There are data emerging, and there's a bit of real-world data, but there's some trials coming that mixing and matching may be a very effective strategy for protection. There is a downside. The acute reactions, which aren't serious, but sometimes can be uncomfortable and unpleasant and last a day or so with the standard approach, with the mix and match can be more significant and longer. So there is a little bit of a downside, and we don't know the full details about the protection rates and how long it lasts for, etc. So there are some good positive early signals. It's a little bit too early to be sure, but it's certainly conceivable in the very near future, people who've received their first AZ dose may well do quite well with getting a Pfizer dose as the next step rather than the second AZ dose. But we're not there yet. I think there's more time will need to elapse, more data emerge before that can be recommended.
Is the slowness of the rollout your biggest concern about the Melbourne breakout?
I believe so. If we had had a significant, proportion of the population vaccinated, obviously it's a high proportion, I think we'd all be a little bit less concerned about this. I think a lockdown may not have even been necessary if we'd had sufficient protection, because you could have argued that the contact tracing could deal with this and vaccinated people would largely not get sick and largely also have less transmission, so there'd be less risk to the remainder of the community. But we're nowhere near that. I mean, we're talking about 70 or 80% rates of vaccination versus what we've got at the moment, which is in the single digits. So really, it's an order of magnitude out, and that's a serious issue. And the sooner we have most people vaccinated, the safer Australia is going to be. It's still going to be a problem with this virus, but nothing like we're currently running the risk for in the current situation.
Can you explain to me the controversy about aerosol transmission?
Yeah, look, it's a very interesting controversy. I think it's fair to say that the paradigm until recently has been for upper respiratory tract viruses, and this is one of those, COVID-19, you know, the transmission was thought to be largely droplet-based. So you had to cough into someone's face, or, you know, the droplets couldn't go or travel a very long way. They wouldn't stay in the air for very long. They'd sink down. And therefore, the public health measures were very much about keeping a certain distance, wearing a mask, obviously, and obviously washing your hands because, you know, you're worried about droplet transmission. But this is a virus that clearly gets out into the air when you breathe or talk. It's a very different situation. It's very clear it does this. There are other viruses that do this too, so this isn't the only one. There's more and more evidence from a number of epidemiological studies of certain outbreaks in restaurants and other enclosed spaces that it must be airborne transmission, not droplet transmission, that can do this. And of course, there's a spectrum between droplets and little droplets. But the point is, airborne seems to be much more important than initially appreciated. And so if someone opens a hotel room door and has COVID infection and breathes out, they can put it into the air and it can sit there for a period in a poorly ventilated space. And then someone else who pops their head out into the same space could potentially catch the virus. And that seems to have happened in a number of situations. So it seems really clear that's the case. Now, there's been some resistance to this from certain experts, some expert groups, I think because they've been in the old paradigm that we were all taught during epidemiology training about droplet transmission. That, I think, is now clearly not the major mode, or at least not the only mode by which you can catch this. So the ventilation's key. And of course, mask wearing can protect you a bit, but not completely. But the social distancing is the problem. It's not enough, 1.5 meters, for example, to protect you from airborne transmission, particularly in a closed space. On the other hand, if you're out running or jogging outside, you're pretty safe. You're very unlikely in that kind of, you know, clearly well-aired situation to get into any strife at all. So that's the good news part of this, if you like.
If ventilation is key, why are we still using hotel rooms that are not designed for this as our quarantine method?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think the answer has been it was the method originally chosen because really there wasn't enough alternatives, at least that's what we've been told. And that's probably reasonably true. But I would argue they should have built those more. And that's a different argument. We know that hotels haven't done too badly. The escape rate hasn't been huge in terms of getting people infected and them escaping out into the community. Some people have estimated, 0.5%? But the trouble is, it's still too many. Every few weeks, we're getting an outbreak, basically, or at least somebody's potentially contaminating others. And of course, at some point, one of those is going to escape and cause havoc. And arguably, that's happened in Melbourne most recently. And it could happen, frankly, in any place where we have return travellers who are quarantining in the hotel system. It appears Howard Springs, it's not a zero rate of escape, but it certainly is better because it's a more outdoor environment with the ventilation issue, you know, largely not a problem. So the ventilation seems to be absolutely key. And then protecting everybody with really appropriate personal protective equipment when they're in the hotels. And that hasn't also been a priority until, still not a total priority.
I'm chatting today with Nick Talley, the Editor-in-Chief of the MJA and a leading commentator on the COVID-19 pandemic in Australia. Nick's co-authored article can be found at the Sydney Morning Herald website, where I believe it can be accessed for free. The MJA's COVID-19 hub is also full of content that's free to all. You can access all our latest preprints at mja.com.au/journal/COVID-19. Back to our chat. Given that quarantine is constitutionally a federal responsibility, but they're refusing to do anything other than hotel quarantine, should the states now be stepping up and going, let's just do this, let's build the thing out at Toowoomba or wherever they were thinking of having it?
I think the discussion of who is now should take responsibility, you know, should the states take over, is one for the politicians. I think it's very clear, though, we need a better system of quarantining our travellers. We've still got thousands of Australians overseas who want to come home and will come home. Yeah. Some of them will be infected and some of them will transmit that to others in the current system. It may be a low rate, but it's not low enough. So it's clear there needs to be a step up by appropriate authorities to deal with this more effectively. And I would argue this is overdue. I think most people really do believe this is the case. It's what do you do, though, practically while you're trying to develop better quarantine systems like Howard Springs? That is one of the difficulties here that the politicians and the bureaucrats face. But to be honest, we've been pretty late to the party to sort this out.
What do we do about those 29% of Australians who just will not get vaccinated for whatever reason? Do we mandate this?
So it's hard to mandate vaccination in this setting. I can understand why the government's reluctant to do so, although I think if you're working in aged care or healthcare, it should be mandatory. And if you don't wish to do it, you should be given alternative employment or something else you can do, which doesn't put you in touch with vulnerable populations who can catch the infection. I think it should be mandatory in those settings. That's my personal view, but obviously that's a government policy. For the rest of the population, it's more difficult. You're right. If one third of the population will not get vaccinated, despite everything, we will not have herd immunity with any of the vaccines we use, at least based on the data we have. It's unlikely we'll reach herd immunity. And that means vulnerable populations who can't be vaccinated for whatever reason will remain at very high risk. And that's terribly unfortunate. And, of course, those who refuse will be at high risk as well. I'm hoping, though, with the clarity now, for example, with the Melbourne outbreak, that this actually is a health emergency. Not ordinary times we can sit back and pontificate. We actually have to do something. And if we don't all do it, we're going to have lots of our family, friends and community seriously impacted, sure at some point. A few percent doesn't matter, but if it's as high as 29, then we'll have a major problem.
Let's talk a bit about long COVID. What do we know about it and what dangers does it present to our economy and to the rest of our health?
We don't know enough about it because we don't really understand why some people, and it's not an insignificant number, some in the Australian study recently was 1 in 3 caught COVID, developed long COVID. Other numbers elsewhere are lower, but still very high. And of course, it depends on your definition too. I mean, but the people who get symptoms that don't go away, they feel incredibly fatigued, they get muscle aches, they feel generally unwell. Some of them can't work or function normally. It's a bit like chronic fatigue syndrome. In fact, some people have argued it is chronic fatigue syndrome in another guise, and maybe there's a virus that truly causes that. Just got one that causes something very similar now that we've identified. That's to be sorted out. But some people have certainly made that analogy. We don't know exactly how long it's going to last. Sometimes this is months, and it appears to be longer for some people. So some people seem to have it and have had it ever since they got infected up to now. So we don't know how long this will last. And there's some emerging data that suggests maybe getting vaccinated may help you in this setting, although that's very early. So we need to wait and see if that really holds up. It's clearly, almost certainly, it's an immune response to the virus. The immune system is obviously not working well in this setting in terms of producing factors that lead to these symptoms. They're real symptoms, it seems, and it's a serious, serious problem. Again, if we had a major outbreak with lots of infected people, we'd have lots of long COVID to deal with as part of that. Not just hospitalization, not just death, which is terrible, but also this long COVID.
Some countries like Taiwan, who've had a very high vaccination rate, appear now to be sliding back into another wave. Do we know what's going on there?
So the data I've seen suggests even in high vaccinated populations, there remain people who are not vaccinated, and there's lots of them. So some of these high vaccine countries, you know, around 50%, not 70, 80, 90%. So not high enough, and there's enough vulnerable people. Yeah. And then there's been some discussion whether some of the vaccines being used, not the ones in Australia, some of the vaccines being used elsewhere may not be as good, particularly for the variants. Although, again, we need more data on this, and it's an emerging area. We do know the mRNA vaccines And in fact, the AZ vaccines for most of the variants provide significant protection. We do know that. That is very clear from the clinical data that's emerged from the real world study. So we've got very good vaccines that do provide protection. And I think that's the key message.
What's the message for GPs here, Nick? Because obviously a lot of GPs are struggling to get supplies of the vaccines. A lot of GPs are on the front line of trying to persuade their patients that this is a good idea. What can they take from the situation at the moment? Clearly, this is a race, and clearly GPs are amongst the front line of trying to get this done.
So I think it's been really, really superb that the GPs have stepped up to deliver the vaccine program. You could have argued that this might have been done in a different way, and mass vaccination programs in the run by the states may have been a bit more efficient and effective. But the GPs have stepped up at a cost to themselves. I keep thinking about this. You know, it's costing my colleagues largely. They're not making money out of this at all. They're actually almost certainly losing money from the effort they're making. So it's really altruistic, and they're doing a really good job. And they're talking to patients extremely well, which is also good. I think what they've been struck with, though, one of the big difficulties has been all the questions patients have about the vaccinations. And so the time it takes to counsel before you vaccinate is much more significant. And that's a messaging issue that's been rather disappointing in terms of the government's approach. Hasn't been a good enough messaging campaign so that people understand what's going on, understand the risks, and aren't terrified of getting vaccinated. So I applaud my colleagues in general practice. All I can say is providing that information for people is so important to reassure them in part, but also to be realistic about the risks. There are some small risks and people need to be aware of these. Definitely catching the virus without in the unvaccinated state is a much, much higher risk than having the vaccine by orders of magnitude again. So I think that's the significant messaging that my colleagues in general practice are giving and need to give to patients so they're aware of the of these risks.
Can you see us needing to get a COVID vax every year, like the flu vax?
So whether we'll need repeat vaccinations is unclear, actually. There are some data, emerging data again, that the vaccine length of efficacy may be much longer than we currently have calculated. But of course, it's early days. We do not know for sure. We need real-world data to help us sort this out. So I think it's a little bit unclear. We may need a booster or two because of the variants until the rest of the world is covered. That I could see as a possibility, which is certainly reasonably likely. But I'm not sure we're going to need it every year. I'm very hopeful that, in fact, we'll have long-standing immunity. We might need it every 10 years, but not every year. So that's at least what I'm hoping will be the situation.
Wave a magic wand for me, boss. What would you do now if you were holding the strings, if you were holding the reins?
Well, I think I'd be doing a number of things. I'd be investing in hotel quarantine alternatives that will provide, you know, significant protection for those that are using these facilities. Because, I mean, there's nothing worse than I can imagine than catching the virus while you're quarantining to protect the community. So that's one important point. I think that's key. I think we need to be preparing for a major outbreak. I'm hoping we don't have one. I think we ought to be both mentally and otherwise prepared for a major outbreak anywhere in the country. And I think we've been a little bit feeling like we were not at risk, that in fact this was all going to be fine and we could just wait it out and then get vaccinated and we'd be fine. Yeah. I think that's not the way to be thinking about this at the moment. And the Melbourne experience is one obvious one. And in Asia, the rising rates in countries that have controlled this well tended to have low vaccination rates mostly is really telling and scary. So we should be prepared for that. And that brings me to my third point. If you can get vaccinated, when you can get vaccinated, everyone needs to be vaccinated, if possible. And that includes children. There'll be some dispute about this and some debate about this, but there's data from the US that, for example, the mRNA vaccines are safe in children, work in children. That's good news. They're approved in children up 12 and older. There's trials going on in even younger children at the moment. The variants clearly can transmit in children and put them at risk. The arguments about should we vaccinate children or not are over. I think the data are clear, at least the emerging data, that children will need this. And that will be a big decision point for the government as well. So there's lots of areas here of attention, but it is a race to get the vaccine out. The sooner we have most people vaccinated, the safer everyone will be. Thank you very much, Kate, for having me on.
That's all right. Thank you. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.